10 years ago today, more than 250 Nigerian girls were kidnapped from their school. Many of the girls who returned home got right back to life with their families. For others, it's been more complicated.
It's difficult for them to adjust to what their parents expect.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. And I'm Carol Hills. Today, we'll hear from our team in Israel.
A server in a restaurant here commented last week that this whole place, this whole country is in need of therapy.
And diplomats meet to tackle the conflict in Sudan.
This was an avoidable war, and it is also a fixable war.
Meanwhile, Poland is cutting back on homework. Kids rejoice. That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for being with us today.
A lot of diplomatic muscle has been dedicated over the past few years to the conflicts in Ukraine and then Gaza. This weekend, diplomats and global aid groups are arriving in Paris to talk about Sudan. A catastrophic civil war has raged there for the past year, forcing more than 8 million Sudanese people from their homes and putting 18 million people at risk of famine.
All of us who care should be standing with the Sudanese people, particularly Sudanese women and youth who are bearing the brunt of this war, to get to a peace deal, to get humanitarian aid in.
Tom Perriello is the U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan. I spoke with him this morning as he was getting ready to leave for Paris.
We need to give so much more, and we need to do it not just one day on the anniversary. We need to make this a steady escalation of the world's attention and its dollars going to the situation in Sudan. The U.S. has been by far the biggest contributor to humanitarian aid, but it's not enough. Both sides of this war are doing gross violations of international humanitarian law in terms of border access, of treatment of humanitarian workers. But we have failed to even get enough resources into places like the camps in Chad, where there's plenty of access. So the world has no excuse. We do hope the countries will be stepping up in their contributions, as we will. In Paris, this needs to be a steady increase of interest and investment.
Even if more international aid can be mobilized, can famine in Sudan be avoided at this point?
Sadly, I think the answer is no, but there are enormous differences in both the scale, intensity, and duration of that famine. We are in a situation where we have, I think, failed to meet that moment. We also can make a difference. We can move resources right now ahead of the rainy season in order to be making a difference, at least with those refugees we can reach, continuing to look for the limited opportunities, far too limited, to move aid inside. And of course, the single best thing we could do on humanitarian access is to end the war. And when we say end the war, we don't just mean a ceasefire. We mean the military back to the barracks, the RSF moving out of urban positions and beginning restarting the integration process. That is ultimately the biggest factor we can have in the degree of this famine. But we are already in a situation where we're seeing malnourishment. You can see it when you're watching the refugees come across the border in Chad, as I did recently. It is visible malnourishment. And we are not doing nearly enough, even in the camps in Chad, to address that.
Negotiations to end the war there were scheduled to begin in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, next Thursday. Now those efforts seem to have collapsed. Why?
No, the Saudis have committed to the talks. They've committed to hosting and to including key partners who were not present in previous rounds. They have not committed to a date and gotten out invitations, which we hope will be happening very soon. But it's also important for people to understand we're not waiting for the talks to start to begin negotiations. We're doing that every day with shuttle diplomacy, with working with the African Union, the UN, with regional players. Those negotiations are happening very actively, but we also do hope the Saudis will be issuing that date soon for formal talks. And then we also think it's extremely important to continue centering the voice of the Sudanese people and Sudanese civilians.
What about the two sides themselves, though, the two sides that are really responsible for this war, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan of the Sudanese Armed Forces and Mohamed Hamdan Hemeti Dagalo, head of the Rapid Support Forces? Are representatives of those two sides, are they ready to take part and negotiate?
Whether they're ready or not, the talks are happening. I think they can decide whether or not they want to be part of those conversations and at what level. But this is a conversation between the Sudanese people and key regional actors to put together a deal that can hand the Sudanese people their future back. Unfortunately, what we see right now is the two sides negotiating with guns and not at the table. We see an escalation of that fighting, and that gives us all the more reason why we need to be moving forward with talks that, again, center the Sudanese people and key regional actors.
Does that mean, though, that regional powers really have to lead the charge and intervene in terms of finding a solution to end this war?
First of all, I think none of us should be off the hook. We all need to do our part and contribute on a crisis of this scale. But yes, we do think that there's an enormous amount of leadership to be seen, both from our African counterparts, who I think do have a strong sense of how urgent this situation is, particularly those that share borders, but also those in the Gulf, certainly the Saudis, the Emiratis, others who are heavily invested and engaged in the country and not always in constructive ways. We need those who have been fueling this war to become partners in peace. And we think, frankly, it's in their benefit to do so, because right now you have a country that is headed towards becoming a massive strategic and humanitarian failure when everybody should be able to benefit from a peaceful and stable Sudan.
As U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan, you are focused on a region that is competing for attention. The U.S. focus on Gaza and Ukraine. It must mean that Sudan is far down on the list of priorities, doesn't it?
Well, within our systems, I think the U.S. has really been a leader. We've had very significant engagement at the high levels of the White House and the State Department. In some ways, I think we hope countries can see the importance of those other issues as a reason to be part of peace in Sudan. I think this is one of the reasons that Egypt seems to be investing quite a bit of effort in trying to end this war, because they already have a crisis on their northern border. Having one on their southern border is, again, something that is instability in the region that the region cannot afford when so many other crises are going on. This was an avoidable war, and it is also a fixable war. These two sides decided a year ago to fight each other for power. And that was a choice, and it's a choice that can be reversed with enough pressure from the region. And it's a region, again, that I think can ill afford to have this crisis where it is, much less escalating in the way that we currently see.
What does the U.S. risk by not paying attention to the war in Sudan?
Well, first of all, I think we have been paying a great deal of attention. We've felt somewhat lonely in paying attention to it. It is something where we feel like, first and foremost, this is just an issue of conscience in terms of the treatment and abuse of the Sudanese people, but also the inspiration of their aspirations from 5 years ago that remain. You still see that when you meet with youth activists who are finding ways to get, you know, relief in, who are showing incredible courage with the emergency response rooms and other efforts. But we know that failed states create danger. We know that in a country of that size, that is that strategically located, it's bad news for everybody if we see more of these foreign actors and extremists start to move in. We know that's not what the Sudanese people want. And I think that's one of the important things for all of the countries in the region, from the Emiratis, Iran, or others. The Sudanese people are watching. They understand who right now is being a force for violence and for the destruction of the country, and who is going to be a partner in peace and a peaceful future for Sudan. And there is still time.
Tom Perriello is the U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan. I spoke with him this morning as he was getting ready to leave for Paris.
Homework is hated by many kids, and if the PBS cartoon Arthur is to be believed, loved by teachers who sing literal odes to it.
Just a little homework tonight.
Catchy tune. In Poland, the kids may have won. The government there has banned homework for young children and strictly limited the amount for older students. It's part of the educational reforms introduced by the new Polish Prime Minister, Donald Tusk. Polish fifth grader Olga Kozak told Euronews she was happy about the ban.
I didn't like this homework too much, she says, and it didn't make much sense because most people in my class would copy it from someone else. Advocates say that a homework ban, or just less homework, reduces pressure on children and moves them away from rote memorization toward critical thinking and creativity. But not everyone is on board. The head of Poland's teachers' union says the decision was made too hastily.
There was too little talk about it and too little consultation, he says. Yes, it had to be done, but there should have been some talk with teachers first. Some observers say this fight over homework is potentially a new battle in the country's culture wars. Poland's education overhaul comes after years of right-wing governance. Teachers' salaries are being increased, and schools are no longer required to teach the writings of the Polish Pope John Paul II. Mazatlan, a city on the Pacific coast of Mexico, was in the spotlight this week. That's because it was the first city in North America to experience the total solar eclipse. Mazatlan also made news because of a controversy around the performance of its traditional music. The World's Mexico correspondent, Tibisa Isaiah, went to the beach to take a listen.
The city of Mazatlan is known as the birthplace of banda music. Origins of this music go back to the 19th century, when Europeans brought military brass bands to the region and fused them with traditional Mexican music. Ever since, banda has become a source of joy and pride for locals in Mazatlan and in all of Mexico. The players of winds, brass, and percussion instruments often play to people sitting in beach chairs in front of hotels and restaurants. But foreign tourists recently complained about the bands being too noisy and that they were preventing them from enjoying the sunsets in peace. This video shows a group of tourists listening to an acoustic guitar session, which is suddenly interrupted by banda music on the beach. The video went viral. Then a local hotel owner, Ernesto Copel, posted another video urging authorities to regulate the spaces where these bands can play.
Las bandas son un escándalo, son un desastre en las playas mazatlecas.
The bands are a disaster on the beaches of Mazatlan, Copel said. They don't allow people to rest. He also said he's received complaints from hundreds of visitors who say they won't return to Mazatlan because of the noise. Signs went up at several hotels prohibiting the bands from playing. And this was enough to drive hundreds of musicians to the streets earlier this month in a 10-hour protest. And they made a lot of noise. The protest turned violent, with some band members hitting police officers with their drumsticks. And the debate caught the attention of the president of Mexico.
Quisieron prohibir lo de las bandas y los músicos.
Andrés Manuel López Obrador defended the band's right to play, not only because it's a long-standing tradition, but because this is how they make a living. Some foreigners also shared opinions. Cyrina Dragons is an expat in Mazatlan.
I know a lot of the nationals say it's really annoying and stuff too, and that kind of thing, but it is part of the culture. And if you want to change the way things are here, don't come. Stay home.
The mayor of Mazatlan, Edgar González, imposed some restrictions, like designating certain times and spaces for musicians. Also, no bands were allowed to play during the total eclipse that brought hundreds of thousands of visitors to the city. But González reversed course, and he told me that he won't limit the activities of these bands anymore.
La discusión ya no se retoma, o sea, damos vuelta a la página.
The mayor says he wants to end this discussion and turn the page. The bands have now returned to the beaches of Mazatlan, but this episode inspired them to organize to break a Guinness record. More than 80 bands from Mazatlan and other cities will be playing at the same time in a huge event planned for July. For the World, I'm Tibisa Isaiah, Mazatlan, Mexico.
You're with the World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills.
A kidnapping 10 years ago today shocked the world.
There's an urgent call for help growing stronger minute by minute around the globe. And this is the cry, bring back our girls.
A militant group called Boko Haram had abducted 276 young women. They were taken from a secondary school in a rural Nigerian town called Chibok.
The group's leader posted a video online threatening to sell the girls.
It is the face of evil, the leader of the kidnappers smiling. With that taunting, chilling warning, I took your girls. They are our slaves. I will sell them in the market.
Protesters took to the streets in capitals worldwide. First Lady Michelle Obama joined the chorus calling for the girls' release.
In these girls, Barack and I see our own daughters. We see their hopes and their dreams. And we can only imagine the anguish their parents are feeling right now.
Eventually, some of the girls managed to escape from their captors. Nigerian soldiers rescued others.
Today, more than 90 of the girls, now women, remain in captivity. Writer and journalist Adobe Trisha Nwabani is based in Abuja, Nigeria. She's been speaking with some of the Chibok girls and their parents since this story started. Adobe, what was it about this abduction that so caught the world's attention?
So the shock was about the numbers, about the ages. They were mostly teenagers, and the fact that they were taken from school, a place that is supposed to be safe, a place of learning.
Now, 57 of the girls were able to escape pretty quickly. 108 were rescued by the military or released through negotiations. What happened to the girls who got out? Were they able to integrate back into their former lives?
The majority of them, they benefited from the visibility and the publicity of the campaign. They had philanthropist charities from around the world, people wanting to sponsor their education. And some of these girls were taken to the United States and to attend different institutions, educational institutions there. Some of them were given scholarships to attend schools in Nigeria. Generally, for the girls who escaped and the girls who were found or freed between 2016 and 2018, the majority of them returned to school. They went on to live relatively normal lives.
That's heartening to hear that there has been this silver lining of this really sad story. Some of the reunions of former captives and their families have been very happy, as you might expect. Here's one of the released girls, Amina Ali, talking with Channels Television in Nigeria.
I just jumped out of the car and come and hug my mom. She saw me and she started crying. And I keep telling her that you don't need to cry. You have been happy. I'm alive.
You spent time with the parents of Jinkai Yama. Can you tell us her story?
We had girls who had got married to militants in the forest. And when you got married to a militant, typically you'll be separated from the group and allowed to move elsewhere with your husband. So in the past 3 years, the Nigerian government has offered a controversial amnesty program to the militants, offering them the opportunity to reintegrate into society if they would surrender and renounce membership of the group or denounce, you know, the group and undergo rehabilitation and de-radicalization. So a number of militants have come out through that, you know, taken advantage of that with their families, including about 20 Chibok girls. And one of these girls is Jinkai Yama. Now, what the parents had been expecting was that after not seeing their daughters for almost 10 years, the girls would return and then reintegrate into normal life. You know, just go back to their families in Chibok and probably continue their education. But girls like Jinkai have chosen to not do that.
You spoke with Jinkai on the telephone and we have some sound of that. So what is she telling you here?
So Jinkai is telling me that she was coerced into accepting Islam in captivity. But she's been released and she says she wants to remain a Muslim. So that's created a lot of tension between her and her parents. And, you know, they've been estranged. They're not speaking. And, of course, the fact that she's also choosing to stay with her militant husband.
Yeah. What did she tell you about why she decided to stay married to a fighter who once held her captive? It's a little hard to imagine.
But I spoke with psychologists like Dr. Fatima Akilu, who has worked with thousands of women who have been freed from Boko Haram captivities in the past decade. They say things like attachments that were formed over time. These were girls taken as teenagers, formed attachments with these men, in many cases had children with them. And then these are girls who have been in captivity for almost 10 years. Being married to those men became their reality. It's difficult for them to adjust to what we want them, to what their parents expect.
I gather that Jinkai's father, Yama Bolum, blames Nigeria's government for his daughter's situation, remaining with her militant husband. Why?
10 years ago, we would have been ready to, you know, hang these men. The whole world was really angry with them. But then 10 years later, they're being accommodated with taxpayer funds. The government official, the state governor who's behind the policy, he explained to me that this is what the girls wanted. And the girls made it clear they would not stay in, you know, they wouldn't remain in Maiduguri, remain free if they were not allowed to stay with their husbands. So the government faced a dilemma. Do we separate these girls and risk them leaving and returning to the forest or whatever else might happen? Or do we support them, their mental health, their welfare, and just give them all the support they need at this time? So I understood the dilemma the government faced after speaking with the government officials, and I spoke with the girls themselves. One girl, Aisha Grema, told me she'd been married to the same militant for 8 years. So she's married to this man. They've had children, and they've come out of captivity. They came out together. And then we say we automatically expect her to leave this man. She's been married for 8 years. So I understood how difficult it was. Oh, it is for both the girls and the government.
In recent years, kidnappings, including those from schools, seem to have been an epidemic in Nigeria. Close to 1,000 people have been kidnapped there in the first 3 months of this year alone. Is Nigeria taking this threat seriously, the government?
We have our armed forces that are stretched. They're confronting different conflicts in different parts of the country. They're underpaid, underfunded, the same issues, you know, we have. Then there's corruption to deal with. So it's just one more crime that our state security cannot handle.
So one decade later, there are still 90 girls still missing. Do we know what's happened to them?
From my interviews with the girls, I understand that about 20 girls died in captivity from illness, childbirth, snake bites. So the rest, from what the girls tell me, got married and went into different parts of the forest with their husbands. So nobody knows exactly where they are. Now, some of the girls say they're still in touch with some of their classmates in the forest. They speak with them by phone, but their ability to come out of the forest will depend on their husband's permission. The state government told me as well that they're in touch with some of the militants and the girls in the forest, and they tell them, well, the governor said one of the reasons why he's supporting the girls to stay with their husbands and making them feel welcome and comfortable is to lure the rest out. So he's hoping that this policy of accommodating the girls with their militant husbands, or, well, ex-militant husbands, will encourage the rest of the girls in the forest who are married and reluctant to come out to lure them out of the forest.
Writer and journalist Adobe Tricia Nwabani is based in the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Reporting for this story was supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Thank you so much, Adobe.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
More stories from around the globe are ahead. You're listening to The World.
A pasta company says music makes noodles taste better.
You know, most people, when they first hear about it, what do you mean that music changes the taste of food? That's rubbish.
A scientist weighs in. Plus, a reporter braves the turf of a gang of monkeys.
I was warned, in this part of town, hide everything. Your car keys, even your glasses. They'll snatch them right off your face.
Ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. All this week, our team in Jerusalem has been reporting on the war between Israel and Hamas. One of the biggest issues in Israel today is the fate of the 133 hostages still being held captive in Gaza. Demonstrators have held sit-ins and rallies almost daily, demanding their return.
One of those still being held in Gaza is 23-year-old Hirsch Goldberg-Polin. He was at the Nova Music Festival on October 7th last year. Hirsch's parents have been tireless in their lobbying to get their son home. The World's Marco Werman sat down with Rachel Goldberg and John Polin, and he asked them about their meeting this week with U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris.
I can tell you that right now the word coming out of Washington is there is a deal to be had, a deal on the table that is blessed by the United States, Israel, Qatar, and Egypt, notably, and that there seems to be some consensus that this is a deal that Hamas should do. And so that was the recap of the conversation with the vice president, essentially. And our other meetings were with other folks in Washington to kind of get them on board to help us push that, push it with other Arab countries, push it with other countries whose citizens are being held. But it seems that there is a deal, and this is the chance for Hamas to step up and end the suffering of its own people and everybody in the conflict by taking this deal, which seems to have some sacrifice or compromise for both sides, of course, but also benefits for both sides.
It seems we've had kind of deals telegraphed in the past, and that hasn't worked out. How confident are you on this day in April that this is actually going to be realized?
Well, this is the first deal that has actually had the
blessing, you know, so to speak, of the four parties who are in the room when the conversations are happening, meaning Qatar and Egypt both have said this is actually a deal that Hamas should be open to. It is really, as John mentioned, I think the chance for Hamas to answer the world that has been really crying out for the innocent Gazan civilians who are suffering horribly, horribly in this conflict. This is a chance for that suffering to end. And so that is what is unique about this particular moment.
Do you have any more details behind that deal that give you that confidence?
Well, we personally are not privy to the details of the actual deal. We have heard that it asks Israel to do a lot of painful things, and that Prime Minister Netanyahu has leaned in to say and has given the mandate to the negotiators to do things that are terribly difficult for Israel. And we are proud that that is even being bandied about. That's even being an option, which previously we had not heard. And we've even heard within Prime Minister Netanyahu's own party the voices that are saying, we must do this. And that is unique as well.
I actually want to correct or point out one word that you used, which is confidence. And I don't know that Rachel used that word. I certainly have not used the word, which is to say we are saying that it seems to be that there is a deal blessed by four parties, but I'm not sure that either of us would say that we have confidence. It's been 188 days, and one thing that has done for us is say we have no reason to be confident because we've learned from 188 days that there are up and down cycles, and so far the deal we've all been hoping for has not happened.
What have your expectations been of the U.S. government over these past 6 months, and has that changed at all in recent weeks?
Our expectation of the U.S. government has been support the cause of the whole region. But specifically, we've gone to them through the lens of the hostages. And it's important to point out that on October 7th, 44 United States citizens were killed on the morning of October 7th. There are still 8 United States citizens being held hostage, 3 of whom are unfortunately pronounced no longer alive. But this is an issue that is very much directly impacted on the United States and by the United States. Rachel frequently talks about the breadth and depth of the population who's being held, which is also important to point out here, because while it's been the United States who's been steadfastly by the side of the hostages for 188 days, there are 9 Argentinians, some significant number of German citizens, Mexicans, French, Thai, Nepalese, citizens from around the world. And we're still scratching our heads on day 188 wondering, where are the world leaders from all of those countries with citizens being held? Why are they not standing arm in arm with Israel and the United States to say, let's get these hostages home, and by doing so, it will have a calming effect on the entire region.
So in brief, have you felt that support from the United States that you were expecting?
We definitely have felt tremendous support from the United States, from the administration, Congress, everyone in the U.S. government who we have encountered. You know, this certainly is an issue that everyone in the United States government feels is unjust. America does not stand for people being stolen and dragged from their beds and held hostage. And, you know, this is such an unique and strange cohort of people being held. The youngest, of course, is Kfir Bibas, who has spent the last 6 months in captivity. He's now 14 months old, actually 15 months old now. And the oldest is an 86-year-old grandfather. And as John mentioned, and I am constantly saying, I think we do an injustice when we erase populations that are also being held. There are 8 Muslim Arabs being held. There are 7 Thai Buddhists being held. There are 2 Black African Christians being held. We rarely hear about many of the hostages who are being held who seem to be different from the narrative that a lot of people want to create when discussing this hostage issue.
That was Rachel Goldberg and John Polin speaking with Marco Werman. Their son, Hirsch Goldberg Polin, was taken hostage on October 7th. The fate of Israeli hostages in Gaza is, of course, a huge concern now in Israel.
But after 6 months of war, Israelis and Palestinians face other critical issues as well. The World's Marco Werman and Matthew Bell have been reporting from Israel and the West Bank for the past 2 weeks. They joined us earlier from a garden in central Jerusalem as the sun set and the city quieted down for Shabbat. Marco, as you have been out and about reporting, what has it felt like in Israel? What's the mood been on the streets?
Our team, Carolyn, arrived here 2 Mondays ago, and the tension immediately was palpable when we landed. And objectively, it only seems to have risen. But I've also seen more in 2 weeks. At first, the mood was defined, you know, by pictures of the hostages, yellow ribbons everywhere. But then the six-month mark since the attacks and the continuing war, no ceasefire in sight, hostages still in captivity after 188 days, people dying by the thousands in Gaza, how those gut-wrenching scenes have rippled out across media in the West Bank away from Gaza, and Palestinians there who'd already felt the increased pressure of the Israeli military closing in on them in those territories, especially since last October. You take that all in, and it leads now, on this Friday, to a heightened sense of tension.
Matthew, I want to go to you for a minute. We're seeing reports here that Iran could be planning to strike Israel directly, maybe even this weekend. How seriously are people there taking this?
This has been big news here all day. We've seen this morning headlines in Hebrew language newspapers online. There's a lot of speculation, but it's saying that there could be an Iranian strike planned in the next day or two on Israeli soil. But what's not speculation is that tensions definitely have been running high since this airstrike in Damascus early in April that killed a top Iranian military commander. Iran blames Israel. The Israeli government is not claiming responsibility officially for that, but Israeli authorities definitely seem to be taking these threats seriously. There was a high-level security meeting earlier this afternoon. Also, Carol, the U.S. Embassy has issued a travel warning for all of its staff here in Jerusalem.
Marco, you guys haven't been able to get into Gaza, except for journalists who live there. Reporters haven't been able to get into the territory except during these very highly orchestrated trips with the Israel Defense Forces. Where have you been able to go, and what have you been hearing about, you know, what is happening in Gaza?
Well, you're right, Carolyn. We're really limited in whom we can speak with in Gaza. As you know, and as listeners know, a few days ago, I spoke with Noor Swerki via WhatsApp. She's a mother in Gaza.
If you don't give these people something to look forward to, if you don't show them that things are moving, they're going to take matters into their own hands.
She and her family have been expecting this foreshadowed assault on Rafah for weeks, and it's not happened yet. That's where she's been evacuated to. I can only presume she and her family remain as fearful as she was a few days ago about what that assault would mean for her family in Gaza. Hope is rare in Gaza right now.
But you were able to get in and report from the West Bank, right?
Yeah, I met Palestinians, two families this week in the West Bank, and it's clear that since October 7th, there's been more pressure coming from Israeli security in the West Bank, and also a clear sense that despite that pressure, Palestinians themselves say they will persevere. I mean, the Palestinians I met in the West Bank, farmers who've been chased off their fields by Jewish settlers, a Palestinian mother and father, distraught by the death of their son in what seems to be an unprovoked shooting by Israeli military. You know, it seems like hope among Palestinians outside Gaza to a person they said very firmly that no matter how many settlements get built around their olive orchards, they will never leave this land.
Another thing, Carolyn, that becomes clear when you meet Palestinians in the West Bank is that they're really connected to people in Gaza. People have family. They have friends there. You go into people's houses, they're watching this news all the time. I spoke with Sabri Saidam earlier this week. He's based in Ramallah. He's a former minister of education with the Palestinian Authority. His family is from Gaza. He spent part of his life living there. He told me that 79 members of his extended family have been killed since the war started on October 7th.
Wow.
I asked him a little bit about how that has changed the way he thinks about the future. Here's some of what he told me.
That's why the feeling of despair gets to your heart when you see that not only your loved ones, your bigger Palestinian family is getting impacted and the world is witnessing in vain. And all what we get is just condemnation and promises of things that ought to be done. Humanity at large has to walk the talk and change this perception of the Palestinians as the underdogs. And this is what hurts me most.
Matthew, one more question to you about the political situation in Israel. We keep hearing that Netanyahu's days are numbered. Is there any indication of who or what party could be the next standard bearer?
There definitely seems to be a consensus here, Carol, even on the political right, where Benjamin Netanyahu stands firmly, that his days are indeed numbered as prime minister. Remember that he's been the longest serving prime minister in Israel's history. Even people who don't necessarily want new elections right now because there's a war going on, they also will tend to say that the prime minister is likely to be voted out of office when the next election happens.
Thanks, Matthew. Marco, is there any sense of optimism among people given the more than 6 months of war at this point?
Well, I told you about the hopes inside Palestinian families in the West Bank that this is their land and they're never going to lose it come what may. There is not a lot of hope, but I did come across that pocket of hope. And there's also some optimism in the near future among some of the families of hostages being held in Gaza. As we heard earlier, the father and mother of Hirsch, Goldberg Poland, they told me they wake up every day consumed with hope that their son Hirsch will return from captivity inside Gaza. If you're walking through hell, Rachel Goldberg, Hirsch's mom, quoting Winston Churchill there, you just keep on walking. Is that hope? Is that resilience or a combination of the two? I don't know, but that's a lot of hope among hostage families.
Powerful quote to leave us there. Thank you for both of your reporting.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Picture yourself sitting at your favorite restaurant. The food in front of you probably comes to mind first. The music playing in the background maybe doesn't come to mind at all. But get this, research shows that tunes can influence how your food tastes. And one pasta company is putting that to the test. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
If this track makes you want to get up and dance, I get it. But Barilla, the Italian pasta company, says you should grab a bowl of bucatini instead. Barilla says this song has been scientifically designed to enhance the taste and texture of their Albronzo bucatini with a smoky amatriciana sauce. The strumming guitar is meant to highlight the bright, fresh flavors like tomato, while a rolling bass is said to bring out smoky, savory ingredients like bacon or sausage. Or, if you prefer a cream sauce, try out the Penne Rigate track. The tight rhythm here is derived from Penne's short length, while a delicate harp and higher-pitched vocals are supposed to amplify the sweetness of ingredients like cooked onions. Barilla released these songs, along with four others, as part of the Albronzo soundtrack. They brought in University of Oxford experimental psychologist Charles Spence to help. And he knows what you're probably thinking.
Now, most people, when they first hear about it, what do you mean that music changes the taste of food? That's rubbish.
Spence says it's not. For the past 15 years, he's been studying how our senses interact with each other, focusing on matching sound to taste. In the lab, his team has participants taste different flavors and select which music goes with them.
Sounds crazy. Sometimes people say, well, no idea what I'm supposed to be doing. What do you mean, match a sound to the taste? It makes no sense. But we just say, just go with what feels intuitive. There's no right answers and no wrong answers.
They've done tests like this in England, Namibia, Korea, Japan, and India.
And by and large, yes, the results match that most people think sweet is high pitch, that sour tastes like sort of sharp sounds, that low pitch brings out bitterness and so on.
How different senses interact is a widely studied phenomenon called cross-modal associations.
And that means that in the presence of one of the cues, our brain might complete the picture and trigger the other association.
Bettina Piqueras-Fisman researches how our senses influence consumer behavior at Wageningen University in the Netherlands. She says taste can also be influenced by what we see.
Sweetness is associated with a warm color, such as red. So that means that the next time that we will encounter a beverage that is red, we would associate it immediately with sweetness.
Piqueras-Fisman points out that much of the research on how our senses interact is based on people self-reporting their experiences, as opposed to brain scans like MRIs. Still, these associations have been studied for decades and are widely documented. Now, companies are increasingly using them for marketing purposes. To make Barilla's soundtrack, Spence matched 6 pasta shapes with their traditional sauce pairings. He then connected the sauce flavors to research-backed sounds and handed that information over to Cristobal Tapia de Vere, a Chilean-Canadian composer most well known for creating the White Lotus soundtrack. Oxford psychologist Charles Spence says his research has helped chefs around the world craft unique experiences for diners. That's typically reserved for super high-end restaurants, though, which is why he likes this project from Barilla.
Anyone at home can experiment with the sounds and see if it does anything to the experience. Maybe it doesn't, but maybe it does, and we can all have a bit more fun at mealtimes as a result.
If you want to try this at home, the rest of the soundtrack, like this song that goes with spaghetti, is on Spotify. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. During the COVID-19 pandemic, downtowns in cities around the world changed. Many still haven't returned to the way things were. That's certainly true of a mid-sized city in Thailand called Lopburi. Though the problem there is, let's say, unique. The world's Southeast Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen explains.
I was warned. In this part of town, hide everything. Your car keys, even your glasses. They'll snatch them right off your face. Nong Tanti Wong runs a car parts shop downtown. She says earrings, grocery bags, necklaces, if they can pull it off you, they will. Sure enough, I already feel dozens of eyes upon me, sizing me up. One stranger yanks at my clothes. Another bears a set of yellow teeth. This part of the city has a monkey problem, and it's getting worse. There are about 2,500 long-tailed macaques in downtown Lopburi, mobbing the sidewalks, screeching, fighting, stealing, all day, all night. Nong actually built a metal cage around the front of her store to keep them out. I asked, how do customers come into the shop? Customers don't come in, she says, and points to a hatch door, the kind you might use to pass things into an animal cage. Customers stand outside the cage. They ask for a product. She fetches it, opens the hatch, passes it through, and grabs the money as quickly as possible. Nong swings open the door to demonstrate. But she's instantly besieged by monkeys. A couple wriggle through the hatch into the shop. She chases them with a water gun. Nong says the city has reached its breaking point. Everything went bad, she says, during COVID. Not long ago, monkeys and humans coexisted here, peacefully. Macaques have long lived in the ruins of an ancient Buddhist temple nearby. Locals and tourists feed them pineapples, eggs, bottles of Coca-Cola. They believe it generates good karma. Then came COVID lockdowns and the end of food handouts. Hungry monkeys started roaming empty streets, staking out new turf and fighting for scraps. By late 2020, locals were posting videos online of monkey battles, up to 1,000 monkeys in paw-to-paw combat. This is the new normal in Lopburi. Whole blocks are dominated by what Thai TV news calls Gang Ling Mafia, monkey mafia gangs.
Gang Ling Mafia Lopburi ครับ โอ้โห ไม่อยากจะเชื่อ มันแบ่งออกเป็น 2 แก๊ง ขนาดใหญ่
A Thai TV news broadcast showing an FBI-style chart of rival monkey gangs with photos of their leaders, their right-hand men, and their lieutenants. Locals call one gang leader Mr. Beard, another the Giant. There are now 4 monkey gangs in Lopburi. The most elite group runs the temple, where people are back to feeding them. Newer gangs have seized an abandoned theater and the rooftops over Nong's shop. One local veterinarian tells me the so-called gang leaders are really just alpha males. That's Rita Jutana Supanam. She goes by Dr. Thay. She says alpha male monkeys are just doing their job, feeding their pack, even if that means stealing lunch out of a human's hands. Thay has given free medical care to Lopburi's monkeys for 2 decades. When officials need help treating or wrangling monkeys, they call her. Thay is telling me how many times a monkey has bitten her. She says maybe 100 times. She doesn't hold it against them. Not long ago, Thay found a newborn macaque, wet and mewling on a rooftop, abandoned by its parents. It now lives in her bedroom. It's a sniffly little thing in tiny little diapers with a hole cut out for its tail. She loves to cuddle it. Humans aren't the only ones in crisis, says Dr. Thay. A monkey troop will only abandon babies when they can't feed them. They steal from us, she says, because they have to. Thay is grateful humans haven't turned violent. They're held back, she says, by a local superstition. She says locals believe hurting the monkeys would bring a curse upon Lopburi. So, how can the humans get their city back? Well, the government has tried mass sterilization. It helps, but the monkeys breed faster than wildlife officials can de-sex them. In recent weeks, authorities have also experimented with capturing and removing the alpha males. That hasn't worked out so well.
No, to the contrary, because the head of the pack keeps the pack together.
Edwin Wiek runs Wildlife Friends Foundation Thailand, an animal rescue group that works with Thai authorities. Capturing monkey bosses, he says, only leads to nasty power struggles over turf.
The troop falls apart, or there is a new guy taking over for the time being. That is not what you want. You actually would like the troop to stay well connected and loving each other.
Thailand's wildlife department says the ultimate goal is moving entire macaque troops to semi-wild enclosures somewhere else. But there isn't a place in Thailand that can hold 2,000 to 3,000 monkeys. They'll have to build it first, and that could take a long time. Until then, downtown will belong to the gangs, run by Mr. Beard, the Giant, and the other monkey kingpins of Lopburi. For The World, Patrick Nguyen, Lopburi, Thailand.
And we leave you today continuing the theme with music from the band Too Many Monkeys. These two musicians from France have got a lot going on thanks to looping. Guitarist Pierre Paturel sets the rhythm line with his guitar. And once that gets going, he sets the guitar aside and grabs a drumstick.
Singer Amy Winter picks up a tiny cheese grater. Then Paturel adds a triangle. And then the vocals.
No, no, what you waiting for? Won't you come?
They stack up the tracks and play like a full-sized band. Not just in the studio, but performing live, too.
No, no, what you waiting for? Won't you come and knock on my door? Won't you make it before the night falls? No, no, I never know.
And he rolls and rolls out. Free as a bird with no one to answer to. No fear, no doubt. He'll be passing through in a day or two. He's a stranger, he's a stranger.
I keep on playing, I keep on playing, I keep on playing on and on. I keep on walking, I keep on walking, I keep on walking on and on.
Never Know by French-British duo Too Many Monkeys ends our show today. The World is a co-production of PRX and GBH Boston. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio, I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a great weekend.
From PRX.